You're listening to episode 25 of Christian Research Journal Reads. On this episode, we are having a special edition which features various articles from the last print journal, which was entitled The War on Western Civilization: Everything You Need to Know About the Cult of Wokeism. This podcast episode covers a few, not all, of the articles contained in this special collector's edition of the Christian Research Journal. To partner with the Christian Research Journal and to continue to bring you the content on this free podcast, please consider giving us a partnering donation, and as a thank you gift, you'll receive this special issue of the Christian Research Journal. You may give a gift of any amount, for one copy or for two copies. It would be a gift of $35, or if you want to get a whole bunch to share with friends, it's $150 for 12 copies. And so please enjoy a few selections from this issue, The War on Western Civilization, Everything You Need to Know About the Cult of Wokeism. None of these articles are available on our website. The only way you can read them in their entirety is to partner with us with a gift for this special issue.
Karl Marx said religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is the demand for their real happiness. To call on them to give up their illusions about their condition is to call on them to give up a condition that requires illusions. The criticism of religion is therefore in embryo, the criticism of that veil of tears of which religion is the halo. America is in the midst of a woke worldview war, an uprising against the Judeo-Christian ethic, an insidious revolt that many Christians have a hard time wrapping their minds around, and therefore we are making available an issue of the Christian Research Journal that you can not only read for yourself, but an issue that you can buy in bulk and give to others who are blind to the revolution that is taking place beneath their very noses. A woke worldview war that is being waged against you, your children, in fact, the very soul of Western civilization. Well, let me start with the woke worldview. Merriam-Webster defines woke as being aware of and actively attentive to important societal facts and issues, especially issues of racial and social justice. In the denotative sense, the definition is proper and right. However, what Merriam-Webster and neo-Marxist revolutionaries mean by being awake to issues of racial and social justice is far removed from the positive aspects of a genuine Great Awakening. As Douglas Grotius makes plain in an essay titled Critical Race Theory According to Woke Orthodoxy, America is systematically racist in principle and in practice. And therefore, justice demands that our national constitution be replaced by an anti-racist socialist system, a system in which diversity, inclusion, and equity is mandated from the top down without respect to individual ability, private property rights, or the positive possibilities of a genuinely free market. Moreover, in accordance with woke ideology, white people, particularly heterosexual white males, are the oppressors. And a primary target of their alleged oppression is transgenderism. In the illusory woke worldview, boys can transition into girls and vice versa. As such, the gods of wokeism attempt to take what the Almighty has made and remake it. They engage in top and bottom surgeries, fully cognizant of the reality that there is much that their surgical savageries cannot extend to. The dirty little secret, veiled in woke speak, is that pseudo-deities are impotent to change biological sex on a cellular level, that the human brain is a sex-typed organ, and that there are inalterable biological differences in how male and female brains are wired. In Gender Ideology's attack on our humanity, J. Richards points to the reality that our bodies are not only organized for physical reproduction, but that humans are by nature both physical and metaphysical, not merely material and not merely spiritual, not half material and half spiritual, both at one and the same time. We are neither upright apes nor ghosts in meat suits. We are by nature embodied persons, by design body-soul unities. While philosophical naturalists flatly deny the existence of the immaterial soul, cultural narratives continue to pay lip service to its reality. In evidence, highly touted Olympian superstar Bruce Jenner told ABC's Diane Sawyer that he is, in his soul, a woman. Consequently, he felt obliged to alter his male body, to conform it to what he perceived to be his female soul. As Benjamin Cabe elucidates in The Inner and Outer Man, how historical Christian anthropology addresses transgenderism, Bruce would change his name to Caitlin, use she, her pronouns, begin publicly presenting as a woman, start hormone therapy, and eventually move on to full cosmetic transition, which is shorthand for undergoing a series of serious surgeries, penectomy, removal of his testicles, breast augmentation, and much more. All of that to transform his original male body into an approximation of a female body to match his, quote-unquote, female soul. Well, in actuality, there is no such thing as a female soul. As Cabe elucidates, the soul itself is sexless. The human being, as body and soul in unity, is made up of the sexed body and the sexless soul. This has been the consensus patrum from the early stages of Christianity onward. Historical Christian anthropology precludes the very possibility that the internal, subjective, immaterial aspect of the human being is gendered at all, let alone capable of reflecting the opposite sex or gender of the body. Ontologically, in terms of nature or essence, it is not possible to be a man trapped in a female body or vice versa. As you read, and hopefully reread, this special edition of the Christian Research Journal, there are three salient facts that I want you to keep foremost in your mind. Number one, the woke worldview finds its roots in a contrived Marxist oppression dichotomy. Two, in concert with previous insurrections, kids are the key targets. And number three, extremism is now the new normal. So first, a few words about the oppressed-oppressor dichotomy. In the Marxist Revolution, society was divided into two primary categories: bourgeoisie oppressors and the proletariat oppressed. Bourgeoisie oppressors, according to Karl Marx, surreptitiously employed religion to trap the proletariat masses in an illusory prison of happiness. With venomous disdain, he dubbed religion the sigh of the oppressed creature, the illusory happiness of the people, and then maliciously demanded that religion be abolished. Neo-Marxism is bent on taking this Marxist maxim to unthinkable extremes. As Noel Mehring explains in Three Dogmas of Wokeism, The Path to Authoritarianism, to be woke is to experience liberation from both external oppressions, such as cisgender normativity, and from the internalized repression of self due to the taboos of an arbitrary moral law. Belief in God is believed to be the apex of oppression and thus becomes the ultimate target of the woke revolution. Little wonder, then, that the pseudo-gods of wokeism seek to remake society as well as the persons that inhabit it in the image and likeness of their own perverse proclivities. Next, a word about kids. Make no mistake, kids are the primary target of leftist woke revolutionaries, which is a chilling reminder, at least for me, I've been to Cambodia many times, of what happened there a scant 50 years ago. In concert with the tactics of the Khmer Rouge, kids are being taught to deny God and to disdain their heritage. In Christian Parenting and the Peril of Public School Education, Matthew Kennedy underscores the sad reality. Public school systems across the United States are adopting curricula, communicating ideas intrinsically antithetical to Christianity. Examples include school-sponsored drag shows, sexually explicit library books, the radicalization in which America and its history is being reframed. And that's just the tip of a catastrophic iceberg. In the words of Jay Richards, children are being taught they can be born in the wrong body, and doctors are treating this condition with sterilizing drugs and surgeries on minors. The so-called gender-affirming care reveals this ideology for what it truly is: the greatest assault on human nature, on our maleness and femaleness, that has ever been devised or even imagined. Adding insult to injury, woke authorities seem bent on stoking the inferno. As Bethany Mandel and Carol Markowitz hauntingly put it in their must-read book, Stolen Youth, adults in position of power in schools, medical and psychiatric settings, and the media are throwing kindling on the fire. It's like handing a knife to a girl who is cutting and then telling her it's a healthy way to express her feelings, or telling a girl struggling with an eating disorder that she does indeed look fat in those jeans and should purge to try to lose a few pounds. For all intents and purposes, the so-called experts are turning our kids into experimental rodents in a medical bonanza that guarantees that they're going to be patients for life. It's like a horror movie, with mad scientists experimenting on hapless victims. Only those victims are our children, our kids, kids emblematic of the bleak future, an increasingly woke West. Finally, I want to say something about extremism. If woke revolutionaries revel in anything, it is in their extremism. Early in the educational process, children are introduced to the gender unicorn, a seemingly endearing character that cleverly undermines basic biology as it guides impressionable kids through a subjective process of sex selection. Taking such extremist tactics to an even more alarming level, the National Education Association has overwhelmed constituents with demonstrably false narratives on tropes ranging from white supremacy to critical race theory and, of course, the 1619 Project. Adding to the extremism, the American Library Association offers workshops with an equity, diversity, and inclusion theme that includes creating queer, inclusive elementary school library programming, developing an online face for a lesbian pulp fiction collection, and drag queen story times in libraries. Meanwhile, publishers have gotten in on the zealotry by peddling the pornographic. Lion Forge, for example, now markets such disturbing drivel as genderqueer, the perverse content of which is far too graphic to comment on. It is not just that smut is being peddled. Educational extremists are bent on banning classics that range from Dr. Seuss's Cat in the Hat to Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. And adding to the extremism in education are expressions of extremism in the environmental industry. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is the queen of queer, has taken environmental extremism to a whole new level. On January 21, 2019, she predicted the world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change. Al Gore, the former U.S. vice president turned global warming guru, is so extreme it is hardly expressible. So extreme that he designated global warming the single greatest threat facing our planet. While he was promoting his documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, he falsified facts, falsified figures to bolster the palpably convenient untruth that planet Earth would reach a point of no return by the year 2016. Nevertheless, Ellen Goodman of the Boston Globe puts those who are skeptical of people like Al Gore or AOC, well, puts those in the category of Holocaust deniers. And then there is prominent Baptist pastor Oliver Buzz Thomas, who has gone so far as to castigate spiritual leaders for failing to urge followers to have smaller families in view of extremist environmental expectations. Here's what he said. We must stop having so many children. Clergy should voice the difficult truth that having more than two children during such a time as this is selfish. As significant as all these voices are, none of them has been able to conjure up the emotional traction of teenage eco-extremist Greta Thunberg. And that by design. Woke warriors, by design, are enlisting kids into their extremist agenda, knowing full well that in our politically correct culture, few are brave enough to take an intellectual shot at a kid, especially a kid given a platform at the United Nations, designated Time Magazine's Person of the Year in 2019, and nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize multiple times. Thus, when Greta made the extremist declaration that entire ecosystems are collapsing, we are in the beginning of mass extinction, and then punctuated her remarks with the excoriation. How dare you? The bait was effectively disarmed. Would that skepticism, as Richards once quipped, would rise as rapidly as sea levels on planet Al Gore. Would that people wake up to the reality that woke warriors have mastered the art of mining the subjunctive, of becoming adept at cultivating the seed of threat buried inside each unrealized instance. Would that we develop a healthy skepticism toward shop-worn monikers such as scientific consensus. As Dario Fernandez Moreira wisely advised, we must be ever wary of stakeholder interests and incentives. Interests and incentives that affect the research of academics in the humanities no less and perhaps even more than those in the sciences. Perhaps it has to do with what psychologists call motivated blindness, which inhibits an individual's ability to perceive inconvenient data. Perhaps it has to do with the innocence of intellectuals. Perhaps it is simply the result of shoddy research by a number of university professors, repeated by many journalists. Whatever the motivation, it is imperative that we master discernment skills in the face of environmental extremism. As with educational and environmental extremism, entertainment venues now revel in extremism as well. Outlets such as Disney, Cartoon Network, or Nickelodeon, all of which have collectively taken woke narratives to unimaginable extremes. The Disney Junior series Muppet Babies, for children 4 years old and up, featured one of its characters, Gonzo, dressing up in a ball gown and then transforming into Gonzarella. For its part, Cartoon Network is bent on providing programming unapologetically aimed at redefining traditional gender roles for children. And Nickelodeon brazenly featured an animated pride parade led by American drag queen and activist Nina West. In their chapter titled When Mickey and Scholastic Went Woke, Mandel and Markowitz asked the operative question, how does the most wholesome, family-friendly entertainment company, Disney, beloved for multiple generations, go completely off the rails? Alexander Solzhenitsyn, commenting on the Marxist Revolution, provides the unforgettable response. Men have forgotten God. That's why all of this happened.
Gender Ideology's Attack on Our Humanity by J.W. Richards. The account of God's creation of human beings in Genesis 1 is sparse and precise. After creating the land animals on the sixth day, the day doesn't end, as the reader expects from the pattern followed on the previous days. Instead, this day has an encore. Rather than just speaking, God speaks to himself. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. Genesis 1, 26 and 27, ESV. Note the reference to a single man, that is, human. God created man in his own image. So each of us is fully human, but with a difference. Male and female, he created them. The suggestion is that though each of us is an image bearer, humanity can't fulfill what it means without this difference. Difference is not quite the right word, though. Complementarity is better. When we come together in the right way, we are much greater than the sum of our parts. One man or woman alone can't reproduce. Neither can two men or two women. but exactly one man and one woman can give rise to the entire human race. Of all human traditions and revered texts, this bundle of truth claims is most clearly and fully expressed here in Genesis. At the same time, it includes basic truths that are or have been known everywhere, in every time and culture. There are men and women. They are both human, but they are different. Men are not women. Women are not men. Men cannot become women. Women cannot become men. It is not possible to be a man but have a woman's body, or to be a woman with a man's body. Until recently, this list of propositions would have seemed trite, but we live at the shocking moment in history when each of these claims is contested. That's because an ideology has overrun our institutions, our schools, our media, our laws, our medicine, even some of our churches. Let's call it gender ideology. Most people really became aware of it only in the last decade. In 2015, so-called, quote, transgender, end quote, people, such as Caitlyn Jenner, formerly Bruce Jenner, suddenly appeared on dozens of magazine covers. And not only recently have most people realized what's happening in schools and gender clinics. Children are being taught they can be born in the wrong body, and doctors are, quote, treating, end quote, this condition with sterilizing drugs and surgeries on minors. This so-called, quote, gender-affirming care, end quote, reveals this ideology for what it is: the greatest assault on human nature, on our maleness and femaleness, that has ever been devised or imagined. Here's how it happened. In 2007, the year the first iPhone was released, there was one pediatric gender clinic in the United States. There are now at least 79, and that doesn't include the 260 or so Planned Parenthood, quote, clinics, end quote, that dispense cross-sex hormones, quote, like candy, end quote, to minors. These clinics are where many minors who struggle with their sexed bodies go to receive gender-affirming care. It starts with social transition, usually in school, and often behind the backs of parents. A boy who, quote, identifies, end quote, as a girl will assume a new name. This will include the pronouns and bathrooms of his new identity. Quote, social transition, end quote, sounds benign, but it's a psychological intervention with long-term effects, and the whole school must participate. No student or teacher is exempt. Punishment is swift for any who dare to resist. The child may move on to puberty-blocking drugs if he or she is still early in puberty, and then to cross-sex hormones, that is, estrogen for boys and testosterone for girls. Next will come surgery to remove healthy breasts, penises, testicles, uteruses, and ovaries. The details, of course, depend upon the sex of the child. Finally, this pathway leads to fashioning faux penises for the girls, vaginas for the boys, and various and sundry for those who identify as, say, non-binary, that is, neither male nor female, or both, or somewhere in between. And don't forget lifelong cross-sex hormones and complications that are as common as they are unadvertised. Defining gender ideology. Sterilizing teens is the reduction to the absurd of gender ideology. But what exactly does it mean? As it has erupted in our culture, it displaces the sexual binary of male and female, which describes all mammals, including humans, with two subjective notions. First, an internal sense of gender called gender identity that is distinct from, even in discord with, the body, and second, mere, quote, sex assigned at birth, end quote. Think of Gnosticism retooled for the 21st century, and you'll get the basic idea. If you were barely following this debate, say, 10 years ago, you might have thought that the claim of gender ideology was simply that a man, referring to biological sex, could identify as a woman, gender, and so be transgender. The ideology is more radical than that. To see this, compare an early version of the gender-bred person with the gender unicorn. These two popular images are designed to train young children in the gender mysteries obscure to their parents. The genderbread person, created by Sam Killerman, teaches children to think of their friends and themselves not simply as boys or girls, but as a compound of different gendered aspects that exist along a potentially infinite spectrum: gender identity, gender expression, gender attraction, and biological sex. The genderbread person went through several versions. As late as version 3.3, it still included the category of biological sex. Orthodox adherents of gender ideology, however, objected to it for just this reason. The image was also problematic because it tied gender identity to a biological brain. Oh, and it still looked a lot like a gingerbread man. The gender unicorn solved these problems. The locus of identity is no longer a brain, but an ethereal thought bubble of a rainbow. And rather than biological sex, our purple androgynous unicorn merely has, quote, sex assigned at birth, end quote. Sex, that is biological sex, has now been fully displaced by an internal self-perception and by a social convention rooted in the subjective choice of the doctor attending one's birth. To resist this toxic ideology, we, and especially our children, need to build up resistant antibodies. Here are two ways to do that. First, get clear on biological sex. And second, show that the Christian view of human beings captures the complex reality far better than the popular modern distortions. Bulletproof definitions of biological sex. An idea so bizarre, so insane, that it contradicts basic biology could come to dominate the commanding heights of culture through only a campaign of confusion. The main way gender ideologues have confused the public is by falsely claiming that disorders of sexual development, often mislabeled intersex conditions, prove that there are more than two sexes, or that the sexes are somehow fluid or mere endpoints on a spectrum. Such disorders occur in 0.018% of the population. In some cases, newborns have ambiguous genitalia. This makes the task of determining sex more complex. Nevertheless, appealing to these disorders to justify gender ideology is an intentional diversion. First, none of these conditions produces other sexes or, quote, genders, end quote. Second, gender ideology provides no new insights into these disorders. Third, people who identify as transgender or non-binary rarely have one of these disorders. And fourth, no such disorders correspond to the growing list of, quote, gender identities, end quote. Now, everyone intuits the difference between men and women. And if you remember high school biology, you know that childbearing, XX and XY chromosomes, and the like have something to do with sex. But biology is complex, and definitions are hard to get just right. A good definition, however, will prevent you from falling for the campaign of confusion. Defining sex precisely. Any good definition of sex will point to the organization of our bodies for reproduction. It will refer to what happens under normal development while accounting for disorders, and it will accommodate the fact that organisms have and do different things at different stages of development. Here's one way to define male and female. A human male is, minimally, a member of the human species that under normal development produces relatively small mobile gametes, sperm, at some point in his life cycle and has a reproductive and endocrine system oriented around the production of that gamete. A human female is, minimally, a member of the human species that under normal development produces relatively large, relatively immobile gametes, ova, at some point in her life cycle, and has a reproductive and endocrine system oriented around the production of that gamete. Again, under normal development, a male has XY chromosomes, testes, and a penis. Females, under normal development, have XX chromosomes, a uterus, ovaries, a cervix, and a vagina. Under normal development, a female can carry, give birth to, and nurse offspring at some point during her life cycle. Males cannot. Males and females also differ in the prevalence of hormones such as testosterone and estrogen, respectively. And they develop distinct secondary differences in their bodies under the influence of these hormones, especially during puberty. There is no gamete and no body plan that corresponds to the recent category of gender identity. Gender identity, as a concept within modern gender and queer theory, is not at all the same thing as various disorders of sexual development, none of which, as noted, contradict the reality of biological sex. In fact, we understand such disorders by reference to normal sex development. There is no way even to detect a gender identity, and yet it has become the orthodoxy in large pockets of American medicine. As a result, the Department of Health and Human Services defines, quote, gender-affirming care, end quote, for adolescents, not as helping children become comfortable with their bodies, but as refashioning the body with drugs and surgery to better conform to the child's reported, quote, gender identity, end quote. Evidence for the benefits of this treatment are in very short supply. As a result, at least four countries in Northern Europe that started down this path before the U.S., such as the U.K., have now stepped back. The U.K.'s National Health Service now concedes that many teens reporting gender dysphoria should receive therapy in the hope that they will do what almost all such teens did before the craze, grow out of it. The far superior biblical view. The idea of gender identity itself is also the fruit of a false anthropology. It's the mongrel offspring of expressive individualism and the sexual revolution. It gets human beings wrong both as individuals and as social creatures. The biblical view, rightly understood, is far better than the alternatives. Gender identity fails to grasp what is so crisply described in Genesis 1. Man is by nature both a spiritual and material creature. We might say that as Jesus is truly human and truly divine, man is truly material and truly spiritual. Not merely material and not merely spiritual. Not half material and half spiritual. Both at one and the same time. Genesis says that in creating us, God took the dust of the earth, but he breathed into it the breath of life. Genesis 2:7. We are neither upright apes nor ghosts in meat suits. We are by nature embodied persons. Christians confess not just eternal life, but the resurrection of the body. Our personal survival between death and resurrection is an incomplete temporary state. We are also sexually complementary creatures, not androgynous replicas. Healthy adults during their reproductive phase are biologically complete as individuals except for one function, reproduction. To fulfill God's command and blessing to our first parents to be fruitful and multiply, it takes exactly one male and one female coming together. This gives rise to children. Thus, the institutions of marriage and family in which children are best raised are the social expression and guardrails of this biological reality. Note that I've run together the biblical view of the human person and family with biology. That's intentional. If the biblical view of man is true, then reason reflecting on human nature can't escape it. Even materialists assume they have free will. Even hardcore Cartesians know that too much drink or bodily vice can touch the soul. Even Marxist tin sociologists, when they're honest with the data, can't help but find that intact married parents are better for raising kids than the alternatives. But because of sin, we tend to distort the truth. Following the logic of the sexual revolution, we pretend that sex, marriage, and reproduction need not go together. And when it comes to the material and spiritual nature of human beings, we tend to lurch from one side of this compound truth to the other, rather than embrace the complex whole. How else to explain how materialism can coexist often in the same mind with transhumanism? The former imagines that we are nothing but chemicals arranged in a complex way. The latter imagines that we will soon upload ourselves to more durable hardware than these mortal shells. How else to explain gender ideology? It implies that one's identity is merely, quote, psychological self, end quote, as Carl Truman puts it, independent of the body. It is somehow gendered, whatever that means, but not sexed. It is immaterial and yet in need of a body refashioned with the latest technology to match it. This incoherent mess contradicts not just Christian revelation, but logic and natural reason itself. To fight gender ideology, Christians, Jews, and fellow travelers need not only offer a fuller biblical and much more coherent view of the human person. We must, using reason, defend basic biology. Three Dogmas of Wokeism, The Path to Authoritarianism, by Noel Mehring. The term woke refers to the state of being alert and attuned to the layers of pervasive oppression in society. While it originated specifically regarding racism, it has since broadened to include other areas of what is considered social oppression, including gender and sexuality. Specific incidents of injustice are used to reinforce the larger goal of a leftist ideology, actually a revolutionary religion with its own dogmas, that seeks to train citizens to see all systems, institutions, interactions, and relationships as defined by power. New horizons of grievances must be continually sought, for outrage is both the sustenance and currency of the movement and the fuel that feeds revolution. Amidst the general upheaval of the past few years, a quiet but no less consequential turmoil has been the rapid wokening of American Christians. While many who, quote, get woke, end quote, follow the path of Exodus forged by the nuns, others choose to remain Christians and seek to bring new energy to the religious left by advocating woke activism as the authentic outgrowth of their faith. Jesus, they say, would have marched in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement in reaction to racial injustice, or embraced feminist ideology to right the harms done to women, or denounced as judgmentalism traditional sexual norms. Because of the reality of injustice and suffering and the centrality of love to the gospel message, many Christians find themselves swayed by this movement that has claimed the mantle of compassion. This claim is regularly reinforced through media and popular culture in subtle and not so subtle ways. Muddying and exacerbating the discussion is the fact that our political disagreements are often shallow sloganeering devoid of necessary distinction. Such slogans as, quote, love is love, quote, love wins, end quote, and, quote, believe all women, end quote, convey a sense of moral clarity but lack any moral complexity. Political questions become canonical and matters of principle eminently disposable. Confusing such things is part and parcel of this movement that seeks to destabilize the foundations of Western culture so that an engineered utopia might arise. Because the woke movement on principle rejects the value of debate and free speech, many Christians, wary of missteps, understandably disengage. This is itself part of the triumph of the woke. The more landmines that are laid for dissenting voices, the more prone we become to parroting right speak and letting the more militant among us control the conversation. But to acquiesce or remain silent is to not meet the times we are in and the damage being done. Targeting faith and family is intrinsic to woke ideology precisely because of the way both uphold the dignity of the person and serve as a bulwark against political tribalism. A well-formed Christian conscience and a well-ordered family are preventative. They prompt us to see more clearly our sins and faults and invite us to look with greater mercy on others. It is often through the family that many come to know who they are as beloved sons and daughters, first of their parents and then of God. Loving and present parents communicate gently but powerfully that the moral law is integral to a loving God and is a roadmap to our happiness rather than a series of oppressive prohibitions. Destabilizing family life effectively undermines society in ways both spiritual and personal. Who God is becomes obscured as well as who, what, and why a person is. As family life collapses, so does the sense of belonging and purpose that prepares one to walk confidently into adulthood. With family life increasingly destabilized, the innate hunger to belong is more acute than ever, rendering political tribalism more ferocious. It is imperative to grasp what is at the core of the radical movement. The operating principles of woke ideology rest on three fundamental distortions. 1, primacy of the group over the person. 2, an emphasis on will at the expense of reason or nature. And 3, the elevation of human power in rejection of higher authority. These three ruling dogmas form a sort of unholy trinity of the woke movement, and each is directly and indirectly corrosive to the faith and the family. First dogma, group over person. Persons are meant to be in groups. In a healthy community, the good of the person is incorporated into the good of the group. In an unhealthy framework, the good of the person is often subjugated to the perceived good of the group. The human family is the first introduction into belonging that a person experiences. This balance between group and person is immediate and intuitive. The baby longs for his mother and bonds with his father. Father and mother are given an intense drive to nurture, care for, love, protect, and provide. The good of the individual is integral to the good of the whole. The dramatic changes in the integrity of family life reflect an acute increase in fatherlessness, illegitimacy, infidelity, and divorce, are not merely in correlation to the rise in identity politics. Instead, as Mary Eberstadt argues, the loss of our primal identity within the family has created generations of people who are wounded, stunted, and in search of what was withheld from them. In other words, the revolutionaries are, of course, right. In losing the family, we tend to lose our very selves and are left to grasp desperately at any identity we are offered. To understand this better, consider how a person is defined by Christianity versus by the woke movement. While the Orthodox Christian understanding of personal identity is informed by all sorts of attributes and circumstances, at his core, each person is made in the image of God and made for him. In addition to being distinctly human by our capacity to reason, we achieve our purpose and are most fully ourselves in relationship with love himself. In contrast, for the woke, we are not to understand ourselves in proximity to the goodness of God, but in proximity to society's evils. Whereas membership in a family is personal, membership in the political tribe is abstract. Each person belongs by virtue of being an instantiation of a collectivized identity. But while sharing in group membership is necessary, it is not sufficient. What is demanded is to share the ideology as well. It is the ideology, not the individual, that must flourish. For example, if oppression is at the very core of womanhood, as the woke say, then woman's perfection exists in fighting her oppression and striving for power. A pro-life woman, then, is denying something central to her womanhood. This sheds light on the pervasive way in which women's issues, women's rights, women's health, and women's marches are glaringly integrated with pro-abortion messaging. A conservative man of color will have his blackness questioned. This was echoed by the main author of the New York Times 1619 Project, Nicole Hannah Jones, who said, quote, "There is a difference between being politically black and being racially black," end quote. Someone who is racially black can be dismissed, ignored, or vilified by the movement if his politics contradict the movement. In lacking the correct political consciousness, such a person is said to be repressing the core of his identity and cannot have an authentic voice. The shift from the civil rights arguments of old and today's woke movement is stark. A common and unifying civil rights protest statement to the dehumanizing policies and polemics of racism was the simple declaration, quote, "I'm a man," end quote. The meaning was not as the very modern ear might hear it, "I am a man as opposed to a woman," but rather, "I am a human being." bestowed with universal human dignity that comes with a common humanity. Contrast this with the anti-racism ideology of Ibram X. Kendi, that the only response to the past discrimination is present discrimination. The claim to a brotherhood and sisterhood based on our common humanity is replaced with a dictatorship of the proletariat. Each person must be viewed first and foremost in terms of a political identity. Becoming woke is having a consciousness that has made this fundamental transition to centering oppression as the core human experience. Vladimir Lenin argued that the oppressed cannot, of their own accord, sufficiently understand the depths of their oppression and therefore need an intellectual class continually reminding them to be angry and feel hated. Herbert Marcuse was cunning at leading and radicalizing youth by selling them on their despair in the 1960s. Saul Alinsky, another influential radical, emphasized the importance of revealing to the oppressed their misery. In his book, Rules for Radicals, 1971, he speaks to the necessity of, quote, rubbing raw the sores of discontent, end quote, to galvanize people for radical social change. Alinsky knew revolution would not come without a militant and uncompromising commitment to fueling fury with division in the populace. While empowerment and diversity are the stated goals of the woke movement, uniformity of thought and ideological power are the actual goals. This totalizing ideology becomes so psychologically coercive that political loyalties can come to replace personal ones in brutal and inhuman ways. Children trained by the Soviet youth movement, for example, learn to reject their old bourgeois familial piety in favor of a fervid party loyalty. Informing on one's own parent became an act of the highest honor. The temptation to allow politics to rupture relationships is temptation for all of us, but the Christian faith is a corrective for that temptation, whereas ideology exploits and exacerbates that temptation by nature. Consequences of the first dogma. One effect of this redefinition of personhood is that we begin to find our moral stature in our victimhood. Social psychologist Jonathan Haidt comments, quote, "The key idea is that the new moral culture of victimhood fosters moral dependence and an atrophying of the ability to handle small interpersonal matters on one's own. While it weakens individuals, it creates a society of constant and intense moral conflict as people compete for status as victims or as defenders of victims," end quote. Raising the moral status of victimhood increases the incentive to publicize grievances and renders individuals less capable of triumphing over them. It further disempowers by claiming its systematic forces alone that are the cause of success and failure, thereby stripping responsibility and meaning from our daily efforts. It is an outlook of despair, creating endless motivation to uncover and accuse culprits outside oneself. Second dogma, will over reason. Well, in the first dogma, the person must be liberated from external oppression. In the second, the person must be liberated from his very body and the internalized repression of self due to the taboos of an arbitrary moral law. This dogma emphasizes personal will at the expense of reason or nature, maintaining that our purpose for existence is expression, to acknowledge, reveal, and live out our authentic selves based on our personal desires, especially our sexual desires. In this framework, societal taboos that limit our true selves are an irrational means of repression. The more unconventional the sexual desire, the more potential a person has for liberation. The identification and expression of such desires require considerable defiance of societal norms, and so give rise to a more glorious liberation of self in their expression. Queer culture is an effective apostolate of this transformation from repression to liberation for just this reason. This explains the popularity of phrases such as, quote, fly your freak flag, end quote, and why, quote, pride end quote. Parades tend to be a competition of the most outlandish presentation of self. The individual is more authentic insofar as he is more boldly transgressive. Foundational to any totalitarian system is the rejection of a stable human nature. We are socially constructed, so they say, and therefore can be reconstructed. Transgressing moral norms then becomes a revolutionary act, albeit one that is sometimes met with internal resistance. Male revolutionaries in the 1960s testify to having been ashamed that they were not easily able to overcome their inclinations toward heterosexuality. Surely they thought it was as a result of bourgeois repression that they were disinclined to have sex with other men. Acts of self-restraint signified a failure of ideological purity. A contemporary manifestation of this occurs in the shaming of heterosexual men who are unwilling to sleep with transgender, quote, women, end quote, upon discovering that they are biologically male. The ideology holds that the trans person, despite having male biology, is truly a woman if he so identifies. The straight man who rejects a transgender person as a candidate for intimacy based on that biology must then be bigoted. Consequences of the second dogma. The fetishizing of transgression explains the escalation we're seeing now. This is the insatiable nature of sin. What is transgressive today becomes boring tomorrow. And so the trajectory, if left on its course, ends in increasingly sinister places, including increasing violence and targeting of children. Our stubborn bodies, which carry the implacable logic of law and nature, are something from which we must be freed. Should a man's spoken identity as a woman come into conflict with his bodily reality, it is the body that must be rejected in favor of the ideology. Should a woman's sexual freedom result in an unwanted pregnancy, again it is the body, hers and her child's, that must be rejected. Targeting children is a byproduct of the second dogma in another way. Traditionally, it is a bedrock of society that childhood innocence is to be preserved. In the world of critical theory, innocence is dominance and therefore a threat. Children must be disabused of their innocence of the panoply of adult sexual behaviors, according to the woke, for two reasons. First, sheltering children from alternative adult sexuality discourages children who might be inclined towards such things from acting on their desires for fear of being shamed or seeming weird. Second, preserving their innocence perpetuates the idea that traditional sexual behavior between one man and one woman in marriage is the norm and therefore the preferred and dominant way of being. Childhood discomfort with men dressed as women, for example, is a socially imposed bigoted instinct which trans activists strive to reprogram. Third dogma, power over authority. Innocence is a threat to the ideology because it points to a measure, to an objective good by which our desires might be evaluated. Innocence also points us to authority. The woke ideological effort to collapse our concept of authority into power when paired with the real targeted collapse of morality and virtue in society is an effective one. In fatherhood, we see this acutely. For many, it is difficult to understand the father as a natural icon of authority when for decades fatherhood has been undermined from without and within. But even with poor personal examples of authority figures, most people sense what ought to have been. Most can reason if pressed about what good fatherhood ought to be and by implication what authority more generally ought to be. A good father imposes discipline, not for the sake of control over those in his charge, but for the sake of their freedom, knowing that boundaries and discipline come before self-mastery. A good father empowers his children to gain independence and take on responsibility. In contrast, a tyrannical father uses discipline to manipulate and control, keeping his children incompetent, afraid, and overly dependent. The revolutionaries from Marx to Marcuse wrote about the need to depose the father by undermining his moral authority through sexual licentiousness. In cutting off the head, the whole is destabilized. Most of our societal pathologies can be traced back to either poor fathers or absent ones. The popular diagnosis is that such pathologies require even further shedding of masculinity. But such a diagnosis prescribes the cause of the disease as the cure. A society with rampant fatherlessness and abuse is in want of manliness, not in excess of it. St. Thomas Aquinas defined effeminacy as an unwillingness to pursue what is arduous out of disordered attachments to one's pleasure. The emasculated man is defined by an unwillingness to suffer. And here we see the intimate connection between the corruption of authority and the corruption of innocence. A society without truly virtuous masculinity will not value, much less protect, innocence. The hashtag MeToo phenomenon exposed the folly of the idea that the sexual revolution can be restrained by corporate sermons on consent, absent the internal restraint and habits of life that lead to virtue. In undermining fatherly authority, the revolutionaries knew that they would also undermine authority generally, specifically the authority of God, who is the originating principle of all being. In the attack on authority, it is his fatherhood that is reimagined as our ultimate oppressor. But in reality, all human authority must be subject to authority. A good leader is in service to something beyond himself, or else he is corrupt. The paradox of ideology is that it seeks to make man limitless by limiting his world to himself. Archbishop Fulton Sheen wrote, quote, "No man has a right to command unless he has learned to serve, and no man has a right to be master unless he has learned to be a servant, and no man has right to power unless he has learned to be obedient," end quote. True authority is grounded in reverence and accountability. In this way, a person's authority is both limited and ennobled. In Christ, we see that leadership in any capacity for men or women is a calling to servant leadership, a rebuke of the old trope that all authority is oppressive. Consequences of the third dogma. The mortal wounds the revolution seeks to inflict on the concept of fatherhood leave a society of orphans. Like a child deprived of a father, a culture looks to fill that void. The unfathered, deprived of real authority in their lives, are the first to yield to the control of authoritarianism. Over the past couple of years, I've often heard people muse about how the, quote, question of authority, end quote, generation of the 1960s became the compliant generation, imploring tech companies to silence anyone who, well, questioned authority. But this behavior makes perfect sense if we understand that there is a chasm of difference between authority and authoritarianism. The call to question authority, popularized by countercultural icon Timothy Leary, was not an effort to root out corruption to preserve proper authority. Rather, it was an effort to undermine the understanding that there is any such thing as authority at all. The ironic consequence of the smashing authority ethos is the irrational compliance with authoritarianism, having exchanged the truth of God for a lie. The woke revolution elevates the tribalism of group identity over the dignity of the human person, human will over reason, and human power over higher authority. What is rejected, the person, reason, and authority, are the three characteristics of the Logos himself. The Logos is the mind of God, communicated in the person of Jesus Christ, who is the author of and authority over all. It is he who is the ultimate target of the woke revolt. It is a war of words against the word. Once the internal logic of the movement is understood, it becomes impossible not to see how such ideas have eventually played out time and time again. Maoist China, Pol Pot's Cambodia, Stalinist Russia. The United States of America faces a crisis that extends far beyond partisan politics. This is a religious struggle. Citizens of goodwill who want to understand, never mind counter, our current cultural revolution need to start viewing the, quote, woke movement, end quote, as a revolutionary religion with its own dogmas. Unlike Orthodox Christianity, which seeks truth through science, reason, and revelation, wokeism is ideological, taking partial truths and totalizing them in ways that require manipulation, violence, and coercion. The three dogmas of the woke redefine both God and man. God becomes our oppressor as well as our subordinate, and man becomes an isolated deity. In ensuring God revolves around us, we conceive of him as being what he is not. And in that void, we make gods of ourselves. It is now we, not he, who seemingly know all, love all, are all powerful. If we keep God around at all, it is for the sake of sentimentalism or custom. This is at the heart of the will's triumph over reason, over nature, and over God. But as with any attempt to triumph over God, the result is not power but slavery, slavery to a political identity group, slavery to the insatiable tyranny of transgression, and ultimately slavery to authoritarianism. An ennobling and humbling way. The division between orthodoxy and ideology, both within and without the church, has reached a new level of obstinacy. Both sides fear the other poses an existential threat to their core values. And in a way, both are correct. Woke ideologies is a jealous God and will not coexist with Christ in the heart of man. One or the other will eventually triumph, one through annihilation and the other through redemption. Perhaps it's time to be constructive, to remember and restore a positive and meaningful vision of family, both human and divine, to which each person is called. In reifying our deepest identity as sons and daughters of a loving God and potential fathers and mothers, biological or spiritual, we situate each member of the human family with respect to his or her duties to God and to one another. Rather than a power contest of political identities and individual wills seeking self-expression, every person is invited to the cooperation reflected in a vision of family life that is both ennobling and humbling because it is a vision grounded in reality and reverence. Our response as Christians should be neither to contradict the times so as to become merely a mirror version of a politicized identity, nor to accommodate the times so as to be absorbed by them. Our duty to love the person is not in tension with the need to fight this dehumanizing revolution. The former requires the latter. We need to see the stakes in the battle, the souls that can be lost, including our own, but also the ineffable mercy of our Lord. The floor always feels safer. A glance at some origins of the modern self and the way we live now, by Anne Kennedy. I'm sorry, Dylan Mulvaney, interrupts Drew Barrymore. I just realized I'm sitting on the floor with Drew. This is crazy. He turns, simpering to the audience, and fake laughs. Thank you so much for joining me on the floor, Barrymore, gracious as ever, leaves off whatever she had been trying to say. The floor always feels safer. It feels nice, Mulvaney nods, and the clip cuts off as the audience dutifully applauds. This, I say to myself, is peak 2023. What more could one expect than for an immensely tall, wiry young man with a deep, resonant voice, dolled up as much as humanly possible in the style of Audrey Hepburn, though lacking the grace and charms of an actual woman, to loom over Drew Barrymore on her own daytime talk show set. Barrymore's soft brown suit and simple hairstyle put Mulvaney's cheap hot pink sham to shame, but the audience still has to clap. Barrymore still has to kneel at Mulvaney's knee. Where's the outrage we had about those old 1950s magazine advertisements of the woman suppliant kneeling adoringly before her husband with a breakfast tray as he lays in bed? Is that hated trope now culturally acceptable as long as the man is the one wearing the dress? Like so many Christians living in a post-Obergefell era, I have cast about in despair for an explanation for how the many moments like the one I've just described, too numerous to count, have come about. While myriad authors, articles, books, and think pieces have helped me construct a tableau of what it means to be a person today. Four have profoundly reshaped my thinking. The first is Carl Truman's unparalleled historical narrative, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. The others, Heavenly Participation by Hans Boersma, Gender by Ivan Illich, and Christopher Lash's The True and Only Heaven, undergirded Truman's work for me in my efforts to reconstruct my own theological and cultural categories to make sense of the present time. Is that an existential crisis? Truman begins The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self with the now nearly cliched quote, "I feel like a man trapped in a woman's body," end quote. Quote, "My grandfather," he writes, "died in 1994, less than 30 years ago, and yet, had he ever heard that sentence uttered in his presence, I have little doubt that he would have burst out laughing and considered it a piece of incoherent gibberish," end quote. Though each word in the sentence is in English, when you put them together, previous generations, as well as contemporary societies around the world not yet caught in the vice grip of identity politics, wouldn't be able to understand what is being said. You, the reader, and I, the writer, both do, however. This is the age of the individual turned unfathomably inward, an age in which the inwardly turned self holds preeminence over not only the group or family, but over the body, the natural order, and even God himself. Three distinct worldviews lie at the heart of our divisions and contextualize the modern self. Truman uses Philip Reeve's, quote, three worlds, end quote, to describe the lay of the land. The first is what we might call pagan. The second is shaped by received divine revelation. And the third appeals to no external objective authority at all. As a missionary kid, I grew up in a first world among people who never doubted the spiritual presence of many kinds of unseen beings. Ancestor, jinn, spirit, fetish. The first world might feel incoherent and chaotic to the outsider, but there is an inner logic of the individual's responsibility with the divine mediated by objective reality. Not God, perhaps fate, but a real and sacred order stands behind the natural order. Quote, "We might think," explains Truman, "of Lycurgus, the legendary ruler of Sparta, whose laws were given authority by receiving the approval of the oracle at Delphi. However intrinsically wise or pragmatically beneficial his laws might have been, it was the sacred myth, the stamp of supernatural approval, that gave them their real authority. Modern versions of this first world transcendent view of life exist everywhere. Indeed, I think they are growing in the West. Henri Morier talks about the, quote, englobant, end quote, the posture of the individual toward the world, the existential accumulation of signs that point to something real. The second world, by contrast, explains Truman, are those cultures that receive a divine revelation from God and adjust their mores accordingly. Islam, Judaism, and Christianity fall into this category. As a Christian, I am most comfortable thinking about myself in terms derived from the Bible. I am made in the image of God and justified before him by faith in his Son. God is the one who tells me who I am. Though the difference between the first and the second worlds might appear to be vast, they share more in common with each other than with the third world. Quote, "The Christian faith," writes Truman, "shaped the cultures of the West in an incalculably deep way. Law codes were rooted in the will of God revealed in the Bible," end quote. Thus, the first and second worlds enjoy, quote, stability because their foundations lie in something beyond themselves. To put it another way, they do not have to justify themselves on the basis of themselves, end quote. Whereas the first and second worlds require no self-explanation, those living in a Reefian third world, notes Truman, quote, do have to justify themselves because they cannot do so on the basis of something sacred or transcendent. Instead, they have to do so on the basis of themselves, end quote. My current favorite example of the third world is an Instagrammer named Jessica. Here's just a snippet of one of her recent reels. Quote, Does anyone know what it's called when you've done a lot of inner work and you've done a lot of healing and you've contributed to the healing of the world in some way? And you meditate and you pray and you manifest and you journal and you do the shadow work and you do your gratitude list and you do all the things. And then the work just keeps showing up and showing up and all the different layers just keep coming. Is that an existential crisis? I have no idea. End quote. It certainly is a crisis, one brought about by a view of the self that is bound by a certain set of moral and anthropological assumptions. Jessica is what Charles Taylor would call an, quote, expressive individual, end quote. She finds meaning by giving expression to her feelings and desires. She is psychologically oriented inward. To find answers about the world, she can only keep looking deeper into herself. She cannot trust any mimetic view of her circumstances as having given order and given meaning to which she would conform herself. Rather, she lives in a world of, quote, raw material out of which meaning and purpose can be created by the individual, end quote. The result for people like Jessica is a day-to-day lived experience that is both exhausting and heartbreaking. Her lament concludes it this way, quote, I was in it yesterday. I went to bed at 7:30, and you know what? That was self-care. I had nothing left in me because I do the work, and I dig, and I dig, and I dig. I'm wise enough to know that we just got to settle down for a minute, and things will reveal themselves, and today they did. And I know exactly where it is that I have to focus my forgiveness work, end quote. Your bright self. Truman doesn't go farther back than Rousseau, or his book would be too heavy to lift. That's where an interlude of Hans Boersma would prove to be beneficial. In the West, before the Reformation, was what Boersma calls a, quote, sacramental, end quote, cosmos. Before the inner self could be rediscovered for its own special goodness, the created order had to be divorced from God's interpretive presence. God was gradually torn out of his own creation by the replacement of Platonic categories with Aristotelian ones. The first solid tear, however, came when John Duns Scotus rejected the analogical or sacramental relationship between God and creation, insisting that, quote, all being is being in the same sense, end quote. Boersma explains, quote, with Scotus, we might say that it became possible to deny the sacramentality of the relationship between earthly objects and the Logos as their external archetype. No longer did earthly objects, as sacramentum, receive the reality, res, of their being from God's own being. Rather, earthly objects possessed their own being. No longer was there a mysterious reality hiding within what could be observed by the senses. The full reality of created objects could be seen, heard, touched, smelled, and tasted. The loss of analogy meant the loss of sacramentality. End quote. Most of us living as we do in a desacralized world can only try to imagine what it was like to live in a world where every object, every person, every relationship analogically and dependently participated in the greater, more sure reality of God himself. Boersma beautifully sums up what we have lost. Quote, by drawing us away from heavenly contemplation, modern secularism has placed on us the burden of constructing our own truth, goodness, and beauty. If the experience of the postmodern vacuity teaches us anything, it is that such a burden is too much to carry. The task of constructing our own reality has led to numerous political, economic, and moral dilemmas, dilemmas that cannot be solved without a return to the stability of a heavenly participation, end quote. Though there are many intermediate steps between Duns Scotus and the Enlightenment, Truman is prescient in picking up the narrative with Rousseau and the Romantics. Rousseau was the first to baldly express the new idea that the inner self is inherently morally good and that society is the problem. Subverting St. Augustine's confession of a young man's theft of pears, Rousseau's delicacy of choice was asparagus. He believed that, quote, his natural humanity is fundamentally sound, and the sinful act comes from social pressures and conditioning. He becomes depraved by the pressures society places on him, end quote. In other words, your inner self has been so encrusted by societal constraints that your pure, bright self is obscured. It is only by carefully peeling back social and familial expectations that you can be truly you, end quote. Society creates the rules by which the individual must play in order to be accepted, and those rules are contrary to the simple economy of easily met innate desires created by basic physical needs found in the state of nature, end quote. I sometimes try to imagine what Rousseau would think of Mulvaney, or if he would have any sympathy for Jessica of Instagram. Would he still think the inner self is bright and good? Happy consumers all. At the same time that Rousseau, William Wordsworth, and William Blake were cutting away all social and familial supports, Truman's description of Blake's hatred of marriage is prophetically unsettling. Assumptions about an innately good self as a consumer began to concern economic thinkers. As rural towns fed their young to the ever-growing industrial needs of big cities, philosophers, unwilling to question the myth of human progress, wondered to themselves how a virtuous society might be built upon the shifting sand of consumer goods. Quote, in the 19th century, writes Lash, the hope that commerce would make men easy and sociable, not only acquisitive and rapacious, came to rest largely on the institutionalization of deferred gratification supposedly provided by the family, the heart and soul of the middle-class way of life, end quote. While Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, and Charles Darwin tried to orient the newly emerging psychological man, existentially thrust back on himself thanks to Nietzsche, to make all his own meaning, economists still hoped a good society, recomposed not around God, but by consumerism, might yet emerge. Quote, by tying consumption to the family, Lash explains, the guardians of public order hoped not only to stimulate, but to civilize it. Their confidence that new standards of comfort would not only promote economic expansion, but level class distinctions would bring nations together and even abolish war is impossible to understand unless we remember that it rested on the domestication of ambition and desires. Liberals, he continues, lacked any grounds on which to appeal to individuals to subordinate private interests to the public good. But at least they could appeal to the higher selfishness of marriage and parenthood, end quote. This, unhappily, is the catch-22 in which many of us still find ourselves. The family and society are the problem, but also, what on earth will you do without a family or society? Just as the individual isn't designed to bear the weight of his or her own psyche, the family, which has been so deconstructed as to be psychologically and emotionally irrelevant, can't meet the needs of the individual. We've arrived at the stage Reef described, where the third world, desacralized and atomized, forced to justify itself at every turn, is an anti-culture. God, once preeminent, is now mocked and derided. Describing Andres Serrano's 1987 Piss Christ, Truman writes, quote, the highest authority of the second world, God, is literally cast into the sewer, the lowest of the low. The sacramental is made into the excremental. And just to be clear, this is not simply an assault on the private religious sensibilities of Roman Catholics. It is an assault on the very authority, the sacred order, by which second worlds are legitimized. Its power lies not in any argument it proposes, but rather in the way the clean is subverted by the vile. Religion is not rendered untrue. It is made distasteful and disgusting, end quote. Neither male nor female, only plastic. The natural consequence of ripping God out of his own universe is that no one knows exactly who she ought to worship. Discussing the feelings of Marx about religion, Truman explains that for Marx, quote, religion involves the perfection and projection of human attributes onto a fictitious being, God, who is then worshipped. If human beings are ever to reach their full potential, they must therefore realize that they should really ascribe the glory they give to God to themselves. Religion hinders human beings from being fully human, end quote. Having to endure the spectacle of Mulvaney accepting the worship and honor of Barrymore, I wish that Marx could be here to see the sort of world I have to endure. Worship can't actually be dealt a death blow, no matter what one would wish. It only gets transferred from God to an infinitely malleable creature. This, for Christians, ought to feel uncomfortable. Truman points out that all three worlds can exist together in the same place at the same time, but, quote, the reason why society now often feels like a cultural battle zone is that it consists of groups of people who simply think about the moral structure of the world in utterly incompatible ways, end quote. For Christians who still believe in God and are trying to, in the words of Boersma, repair the tapestry, the question of what constitutes the self is not an answered question. We can believe in God, but we are constrained by assumptions we have adopted, ironically, from our exile in the third world. Moreover, technology, at least as much as worship and scripture, shapes the Christian's posture toward the world, not to mention the feelings about the self. The sex role in our technological plastic age. How ought men and women imagine themselves? Should they be plastic, consuming selves illumined by their phones? Or should they be free to adopt whichever identity they scroll past? On this question, I found Ilyich's book, Gender, to be most provocative. Ilyich distinguishes between what he calls vernacular gender, a concept derived from the idea of vernacular speech, and economic sex. Economic sex, he says, came into its own with the Industrial Revolution. Quote, the concept of sex role, he writes, could not come into being until society's institutions were structured to meet the genderless needs of genderless clients with genderless commodities produced in a genderless world. The sex role builds on the existence of genderless man. One sex, however, is not perceived as just one more role, one more outfit to don, one more well-fitting or ill-tailored suit for special occasions like the role of parent, academic, or plumber. Most people consider the sex role less changeable. Women know that they are stuck with it in an oppressive way. But like it or not, to have a sex role, be it assumed, imposed, or resented, is something other than belonging to a gender. It is one thing to say that you are a man or a woman, and something quite different to say that you are a human being of male or female sex. Unlike gender, which means that you are either a square or a circle, the sex role is like a foundation on which other roles can be built. Emphasis in the original. If Mulvaney wants to celebrate 365 days to, quote, girlhood, end quote, even though he is a full-grown man, no woman can say anything about it. This is the world in which we live and move and have our being. However alien and uncomfortable it might feel to live in such a way, the distinctions between male and female, God and man erased, we cannot but bow to a certain acceptance of our own technological plastic age. Oh, that I had wings like a dove. Quote, my heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fear and trembling come upon me, and horror overwhelms me. And I say, oh, that I had wings like a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. Yes, I would wander away. I would lodge in the wilderness. Selah. I would hurry to find a shelter from the raging wind and tempest. End quote. Psalm 55, 4 through 8, ESV. Barrymore's lamentation, "The floor always feels safer," is a wonderful insight into the grievous condition of the atomized self enduring a desacralized plastic world. There is at least one excellent reason to describe the floor as safer. It means you've gone down as far as you can go. You can't fall if you're already on the floor, for that is the great agony of being a self who has to make all her own meaning, there's nothing underneath, no support, no reason to say no to anything. In this context, Christians have only one place to turn to, the scriptures, which have already described the world in which we live. The modern self can be found in the third chapter of Genesis, when God's great enemy invited Adam and Eve to trust themselves rather than their creator. The rest of scripture unfolds God's response to their terrible, death-dealing choice. Each passage tells the story of the individual caught and rescued by God. It is the most alarming, most apocalyptic of any story told anywhere, at any time, by any culture. Christians trying to find a place to hide or a place to stand can always turn to the God who stood in their place, who took on the fury of hell and, in the words of Nietzsche, died. Except that he did not stay dead. He rose again from the grave. He snatches people out of the world one by one and joins them to his own body. He sets their feet on a sure footing and hides them under the shadow of his wing. He is their hope and salvation, the source of all that satisfies them. If you are looking for a safe refuge from the storm, sink down upon the safety of the rock that is higher than you. How to keep your job without losing your soul, a survival guide for diversity training by John Ferrer. You've been at your job for almost a year. You enjoy your work. You're planting roots. Soon you'll qualify for a pay raise and new benefits. Things are looking up. Except, at today's business meeting, the boss announced a mandatory diversity training for all employees. He made it sound harmless, perfunctory, just a hoop to jump through. No one asked questions. Everyone just nodded. Since you're new, you held your questions. You don't want to cause a stir. Still, something smells fishy. Maybe you've heard stories about DEI, SEL, CRT, or unconscious bias training. Maybe you've been through this before and you know it's coming. But whatever is bothering you, there's a decision to make. What will you do about this diversity training? You've got options, but before picking one, you should know what you're up against. Background check. On the surface, diversity training seems like a great idea. Everyone agrees that racism, sexism, and bullying are bad. But everyone has their biases, too. So with a little coaching, maybe we can get along better, become more productive, solve problems, and have a healthier workplace. Not to mention, we might avoid a harassment suit or messy discrimination case down the road. Diversity training can be incorporated into, quote, leadership training, career advancement, or onboarding programs, end quote. But the big takeaway is that the workplace, school, or church needs to get ready for more diversity and the challenging opportunities that it presents. Advocates like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce claim diversity training is a business imperative, so companies can provide, quote, opportunities for everyone to, quote, help lift communities and strengthen the health, prosperity, and competitiveness of our nation and our society, end quote. In the past, these programs were called, quote, sensitivity training, end quote, reflecting a growing awareness of sexism and harassment in the workplace. But today, they're often more about racial and LGBTQ diversity with a progressive political spin. Some of the more gracious critics say diversity training just doesn't work. Anthropologists Frank Dobbin and Alexandra Kalev explain, quote, diversity training is like the most expensive and least effective diversity program around. But corporate, church, and school representatives persist, worried about the optics of getting rid of training, concerned about litigation, unwilling to take more difficult but consequential steps, or they're simply in the thrall of glossy training materials and their purveyors. That colleges and universities in the United States persist in offering training to faculty and students and even mandate it, 29% of all schools require faculty to undergo training, is particularly surprising given that the research on the poor performance of training comes out of academia. End quote. Harsher critics argue that the multi-billion dollar diversity training industry is a Trojan virus packaged in slick, appealing buzzwords, yet filled with corruption, extortion, and radicalism. Probably worse than you thought. If this article were a diplomatic venture, then one might suspend critique and say, experts disagree and move on. But that attitude wouldn't faithfully capture the urgency of this issue. Increasingly, diversity training has shown itself to be a deeply corrupt and disingenuous industry smuggling neo-Marxism into the corporate world under the guise of team building and etiquette training. There is no long-term, well-vetted evidence showing that diversity training achieves greater diversity, equity, or inclusion. Instead, workplace relations are typically worse after diversity training. It's not that diversity is a problem, mind you. To my knowledge, people don't object to meaningful diversity, including ideological diversity. Nor do people object to equal human rights or broadly inclusive work environments. The objections stem from heavy-handed tactics and politically charged ideology cloaked in the buzzwords, quote, diversity, equity, and inclusion, end quote. I tend to agree with the harsher critics of DEI, including Douglas Grotius, Noel Mehring, J.W. Richards, Vody T. Bauckham Jr., Heather McDonald, James Lindsay, Christopher Rufo, Mary Graybar, Abigail Schreier, Matt Walsh, Bethany Mandel, Carol Markowitz, and others. Diversity training broadly fails at promoting diversity. Rather, it reinforces stereotypes and erodes trust while fostering hypersensitivity, division, and avoidance. It could be argued that diversity training is mostly just window dressing, companies virtue signaling to stay marketable. While there is some window dressing, there's a lot more to the story. What's behind this diversity training? To understand why the diversity training industry has boomed, and with it, countless companies shoehorning race and LGBTQ into their media marketing, one has to follow the money. Consider Nike and Bud Light. Both named Dylan Mulvaney, a grown man identifying as a girl, as their brand ambassador. If you've seen Nike or Bud Light commercials, you know that's a profoundly counterintuitive choice. Both companies have taken heavy fire from their customer base, seeing it as woke virtue signaling. These companies are not playing to their base. These campaigns are hurting sales among individual consumers, but those aren't the only customers to consider. For any given company, there is an array of corporate customers, including suppliers, distributors, corporate buyers, contractual partners, investment firms like BlackRock and Vanguard, lobbying groups like Human Rights Campaign Foundation, HRC, and any number of industrial, commercial, legal, or government cogs in the machine of big business. Companies have to satisfy all these customers if they hope to stay in business. And the bigger the company, the more of these customers they have to satisfy. And the more they stand to lose if, for example, HRC gives them a bad diversity score on the, quote, corporate equality index, end quote. A failing grade from HRC can get a company blackballed across the industry, terminating contracts, freezing funds, and redirecting investments and contracts away from them. Political lobbies can leverage this diversity score, forcing companies to hire more radical and LGBTQ minorities, host diversity trainings, fire targeted employees, conduct diversity events, and jump through hoop after hoop until they're allowed to do business again. The rise in diversity training is a pay-to-play extortion scheme where companies must comply or be canceled. Cullen Linebarger explains, quote, the Human Rights Campaign, HRC, the forefront of the leftist LGBTQ mafia, is utilizing a social credit score to force companies like Nike and Anheuser-Busch to advance their poisonous agenda, end quote. Moreover, quote, the HRC publicly threatens organizations every year by sending a list of demands in person over what they want to display in public. Clearly, Mulvaney was part of those marching orders. The HRC is backed by hedge funds such as BlackRock and Vanguard, the top shareholders of most American publicly traded corporations. Failure to advance the woke agenda, according to Linebarger, would lead to these companies pulling their funds from Nike, Anheuser-Busch, and other major companies, leading to the loss of millions of dollars. All of this means that major corporations actually lose more by not embracing the woke left than from angering conservatives. So much for the get woke, go broke slogan, end quote. There's a lot to unpack here, but the takeaway is that diversity training is part of a larger socio-political incursion. It should not be taken lightly. From the standpoint of employers, bosses, owners, diversity training represents a concession to powerful forces injecting progressive leftist politics into the workplace. From the standpoint of average employees, diversity training is an ideological arm twisting. Comply or else. How alarmed should we be here? Clearly, we should be alarmed, but how alarmed should we be? If this is a 5-alarm fire, then the only prescription is to get out now. In some cases, that's exactly what's happening. Many companies in progressive Portland, Oregon, reach that point. They won't have to conduct diversity training in their Portland stores because they abandoned those stores. For individual employees, hearing the, quote, get out now, end quote, alarm means leaving your job. It might even mean leaving the state. In recent years, thousands of families have migrated from the left coast, California, Washington, Oregon, for red state bastions like Texas and Florida. Undoubtedly, many are evading woke job training, groomer schools, and progressive politics. But not everyone can afford to lose their job or leave town. Or your in-laws own the company, or you run the business and hundreds of employees depend on you, or you've invested so much ministry into the company that you can't justify leaving. Now, to be clear, Christians should be faithful to God no matter the cost. Our faithfulness should never depend on the economy, the job market, or a reprimand at work. We should follow God in Christ above all else. We do, however, need room for nuance. In the real world, we just don't need zealous faith, but calm wisdom as well. We need to see the competing needs and values tangled up in this decision. Sometimes there's a narrow path forward that we can't see until we've untangled the briars through lots of prayer and discernment. We're counting the cost and measuring trade-offs. Quitting your job might be the best way to serve God faithfully, though it will delay your retirement, take a toll on your marriage, and strain your relationship with the kids. For some people, their marriage is on the rocks, and a job loss would virtually guarantee a divorce. I'm not prepared to tell that person their marriage is worth the sacrifice. For other people, they're too eager to leave their job. For them, quitting would be self-righteous and boastful, play acting the role of a martyr, and doing more harm than good. There is no one-size-fits-all prescription here. Whatever is the best direction for you, make sure you can present it as a wise and righteous sacrifice to God. Yes, the diversity training industry is very alarming. Yes, the trends indicate that progressive ideologues are imposing themselves wherever they can. But heeding those alarms, you still need to discern whether your case requires you as a Christian to advance the line, retreat and regroup, or just hold the line. Compliance warning. The average employee won't be thinking that far ahead. They won't know how the diversity industry is rife with progressive neo-Marxism. They won't know that the diversity training activities are modeled after struggle sessions from the Cultural Revolution, Maoist China. They won't know that the Corporate Equality Index mirrors the authoritarian social credit system tyrannizing China right now. Most employees won't object. They'll go along to get along. Compliance is commonplace. Christians often behave the same way, thinking they're being meek and mild, just like Jesus. Indeed, Paul says, quote, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone, end quote. Romans 12:18. We Christians should be peacemakers. While that's not exactly compliance, it can look the same. But even if you decide to partake in the training, there's no option for mature Christians to be lazy and compliant. Whether it's a diversity seminar, critical race class, or whatever it is, you'll be offered a buffet of ideas, and they might even try to force feed it to you. So if you're in the habit of ingesting whatever authorities feed you, then you're likely to swallow something toxic. Passive compliance isn't a responsible option. Is it really mandatory? Fortunately, mandatory training isn't always mandatory. If it's just suggested or if it's only mandatory at the office, then you can decline it or possibly miss work on those days. Undercover operation. Even if the training is optional, however, you may still decide to attend, say for research purposes or as an undercover whistleblower. Expect that it won't be 100% wrong or 100% right either. You'll need discernment, tact, and willpower. You'll need to be well-grounded. Most importantly, make sure to live not by lies. Measure your words. Guard your actions. Sign only what you agree with. Speak only truth. If you're required to sign a position statement, then politely decline. Your Christian testimony is more valuable than any paper or screen they put in front of you. Quote, above all else, Scripture warns, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. Proverbs 4:23. Now suppose you can't be out of the office those days you're required to attend, and you aren't gifted with the subtle skills of an undercover agent. If a diversity seminar promotes divisiveness rather than diversity, it stirs up more racism than reconciliation. Then you may have valid grounds for religious exemption. If you're on good terms with your manager, you could request that. They might write an exception clause for you. If this diversity training is meant to prevent discrimination suits, then they might grant a religious exemption for fear of a lawsuit. Your human resources department can probably help you know your rights. If not, then call a lawyer friend or even contact Alliance Defending Freedom, www.adflegal.org, and American Center for Law and Justice, www.aclj.org, or the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, www.thefire.org. It is mandatory. What now? Avoidance, of course, isn't always an option. Legally speaking, the company can choose the expectations and values for their employees. And there are many creative ways they can obey the law while forcing you to conform. At this point, your options are more limited. Two extremes are leave or lawyer up. Leave. I mentioned this above. If you decline the training and they fire you, then you might qualify for severance. If you quit, however, you might lose those rights. Either way, if you leave your job, you might also lose health insurance, friends, advancement opportunities, and ministry influence in the company. Plus, you can be replaced with someone more compliant, surrendering the territory to the same forces you are protesting. Christians must count the cost. Following Jesus takes a toll. Quote, if anyone would come after me, Jesus said, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Matthew 16:24, ESV. Lawyer up. Another extreme option is to lawyer up. Yes, Christians should be forgiving, not litigious, 1 Corinthians 6:7. But that's a general principle, and it's between church members. In corporate settings, there can be righteous lawsuits. Christians have a general duty beyond their own interests to seek justice for other people. Micah 6:8. And if your company's diversity trainers teach people to be less white or that black people can't be racist or white people are demons, then legal action might constitute a righteous defense rising to the level of egregious offense. But be warned, this option is expensive and you might not have a case. The diversity training industry is a big, well-funded, with lots of lawyers and even a few U.S. Supreme Court precedents on their side. Regents versus Bake, 1978, and Grutter versus Bollinger, 2003. However, in a recent SCOTUS case, Students versus Harvard College, 600 U.S., 2023, the court held that college affirmative action programs violate the Equal Protections Clause of the 14th Amendment. As such, this legal landscape is unsettled. After the training, the moderate option is to attend, but it's not moderate in the sense of being safe or easy. It's moderate in the sense that it doesn't directly escalate conflict, and you might be able to fly under the radar. Just remember, this option can be very dangerous for your faith and your family. You may be tempted to just avoid the training because you're a compliant person or to avoid making a scene. Those are not good enough reasons to subject yourself to the aggressive indoctrination typical in diversity training. Cowardice, cooperation, and compliance are terrible reasons to attend. People shouldn't participate in DEI training unless they're acting from courage. Additionally, a committed follower of Christ must act with wisdom, love, and a firm Christian conviction that this is the best way they can serve the company, their community, their family, their marriage, and their God. To be safe and effective during diversity training, you would probably need the spiritual gifting equivalent of spycraft. You basically be an ideological spy, an undercover agent, as mentioned above. You need the skill and maturity to navigate through spiritually hostile territory and remain undaunted. Most people don't have that sort of gifting. Only 12 Israelite spies were originally commissioned for a reconnaissance in Canaan, Numbers chapters 13 and 14. They were sent with God's blessing to cross dangerous territory and spy on a foreign land filled with enemy combatants. Yet despite having God's blessing and the support of all Israel, only 2 of the 12 kept the faith. 10 of them lost heart upon seeing what they were up against. That's less than a 17% success rate. Surveying the state of discipleship training in churches today, we're not likely to do any better. 4 strategies for mandatory diversity training. If your best option is to attend the seminar, then you still have the choice of how to carry yourself during the training. What will your strategy be? James Lindsay outlines 4 options. Greyrock. Gray rock refers to passive resistance. You present yourself as a boring gray rock, unengaged, uncommunicative, calm, using short answers and limiting exposures. This isn't a good option, but it's likely to fit many people's personality and training. Not everyone can handle trolling, spying, or outright resistance, but most people can be dry and boring if they had to. Spying. Whistleblowing or spying is a riskier option where you play along, cooperating as if you're compliant, but you're really recording, gathering notes, and preparing to blow the whistle. I alluded to this earlier as undercover agency. This isn't for everyone, but it's an important inclusion because someone has to endure these training sessions if the world is going to know what's in them. You still shouldn't say or do anything against your conscience. And know that whenever people discover you're the whistleblower, you'll likely lose your job or worse. Outright resistance. Another risky option is to openly resist. You could refuse to attend, write a letter to the board, stage a walkout, host a press conference, and so forth. Again, the firing risk is high. Done right, however, it can be very effective, especially if most of the company is involved. Know that the bigger the protest, the harder it will be to pull off. And as tensions escalate, you risk looking like the bad guy. Trolling. Trolling is an accelerationist strategy where the troll gives false information like jokes, sarcasm, or memes to elicit responses derailing the event. quick-witted class clowns have been doing this at school for ages. Some people have just the personality to pull this off, but it's an advanced strategy. You may need to know the material better than the trainer does so you can exploit holes in their arguments and evidential gaps. You risk coming off as adolescent, insincere, and rude. For Christians, this isn't generally a safe strategy, especially if it turns into mocking people or picking fights. Expect to lose your job with this strategy, too. The fifth strategy, Christian wisdom. As Christians, we can add a fifth option. Scripture exhorts followers of Christ to live at peace with everyone as far as we're able, treating people with the respect and love they deserve as image bearers. See Genesis 1, 26 through 28, Mark 12, 31, Romans 12, 18. While we won't agree with evil or lies, we can listen graciously, affirm the good, speak only when it's helpful and only when it's true. Even if the diversity seminar is flooded with bad ideas, Christians can hold fast to the truth, steadfast against the confusing torrent. At times, Christian may need the gray rock strategy number one, and we should take good notes, preparing to blow the whistle if we must, number two. If the training requires agreeing with lies, foolishness, or evil, then we'll have to decline in open resistance, number three. We may even need to point out bad logic with a pointed question or joke, number four. We can be merciless toward bad ideas as long as we're merciful toward people. The important thing here is to be a good example of Christ, exercising wisdom throughout. As you watch or listen to a mixture of good and bad ideas, you can chew what they feed you, so to speak, swallowing the good and spitting out the bad. You might not have any great earthly options available, but you can always fear God and trust in Him because, quote, we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to His purpose. Romans 8:28, ESV. See also Proverbs 3:5-8. If you measure your words, guard your heart, and keep the faith, you can stand your ground. May God bless your effort. You've been listening to episode 25 of the Christian Research Journal Reads podcast from the Christian Research Journal and the Christian Research Institute. We have focused on giving you several articles from our very special issue of our journal. It was the very last print issue that we published after more than 45 years in print. But the work continues with the Christian Research Journal, so would you please partner with us? And if you partner with us, you can get this collector's edition of this journal, The War on Western Civilization. Simply go to equip.org, equip.org, and then scroll down. You will see a picture of the last issue. If you click on that, you'll go to a page where you can give a partnering gift for 1, 2, or even 12 issues in a bundle of this very last issue that we had in print. And so we hope you've enjoyed this special edition of Christian Research Journal Reads. We continue to bring you brand new articles every week, and you will find them on our website, equip.org, as well as the other podcast associated with the journal, which is the Postmodern Realities podcast. This summer in 2024, we will be celebrating 400 episodes over the last 8 years, where we have talked about 400 articles from the Christian Research Journal and interviewed their authors. So please subscribe to that podcast along with this one, and also help us continue to bring now all this content free of charge to you by giving us a donation for this very special issue.